Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1. With Olay Total Effects Age-Defying Day Cream. Over 100 awards without paying hundreds of euros.
We're going to start with some music. Good morning, Jack O'Rourke.
Good morning, Miriam.
I was reading the Hot Press set of your new album, Jack, that has established you now as one of Ireland's most gifted songwriters. We're going to chat later on, but you're going to sing for us first. What are you going to sing for us?
I'm going to do a new song called Ithaca.
What's it about?
Coming home.
Great. Okay, yeah. Off you go.
Thank you.
Rules of travel come undone. You drop your compass, I was always waiting. Muslin holds your tired arms. Our hieroglyphic limbs entangle, gasping. There's no need to run away. Choose to stay. Sirens call, but you and I outsing them. I could be your wanderlust. I could be your journey's end. You're homeward bound, you're lost and found. You're Ithaca. Southern poles, my northern lights. We sail on lunar tides that shine magnificent. I wipe the eyes of all your storms. Dramatic landscapes fall away to valley. Without a stern, lie beneath your wings that soared like condors, lighting fires to bring you home. Let's watch the burning embers rise like wishes. There's no need to run away. Choose to stay. If sirens call, then you and I'll outsing them. I could be your wanderlust. I could be your journey's end. You're homeward bound. You're lost and found. You're Ithaca.
Thanks so much for that, Jack. It's beautiful. You're going to come back later on at the end of the show. We'll chat and you're going to sing for us again.
I look forward to it.
Joe Schmidt presided over a golden period in Irish rugby. 3 Grand Slam championships in 6 years, beating the All Blacks twice, triumphs over South Africa, England and Australia. He brought control and discipline to the team, working with players who will go down in history as some of the best ever. At the end of last year, Ireland was crowned the greatest rugby team in the world. Then Joe announced his departure from the squad, and since then, over the past year, the team never really managed to regain its phenomenal success of the previous 6 years, and it all seemed to fall apart at the recent World Cup. Well, Joe Schmidt has just written his autobiography called Ordinary Joe, and he's with me now. Good morning, Joe Schmidt.
Morning, Miriam.
Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
Listen, what's your life like these days? Because I know you hadn't taken a full day off in about 6.5 years when you were the Irish coach. So what do you do all these days?
Pretty full, really. I spent Tuesday, Wednesday with the current coaching staff and had a good chat with them, and I envy them a little bit because we're all a bit scarred by the World Cup and how it finished, but they're all now projecting their thoughts forward to the Six Nations and I've got nowhere to go. So it was good to catch up with them, and I'm doing a little bit of this and chatting to people, which I feel a little bit more comfortable about. Because straight after the World Cup, it was pretty tough going, because I was I was disappointed, but I felt that other people would be disappointed as well. Yesterday, I got along to Limerick early in the morning and spent the morning helping out with the tertiary scholarships that JP McManus donates very kindly, and there are a lot of them. So that was great. And then last night, I was at the Wanderers' 150th anniversary. There were, I think, about 900 people there, and they had a great night. So that's kind of how I'm filling my time at the moment, and I'm kind of a little bit lost without the coaching, but I will find my feet pretty quickly, I'm sure.
Are you under Kelly, your wife's feet, a lot more than you used to be? Is she getting in any way irritated?
No, not at all. I was for the first week, and she got us away to Spain for a few days because I was just a little bit disappointed with how we'd finished, and I felt other people would be disappointed, and I didn't really want to get out and about. And we saw Irish people every day. We were in Spain, and they were so lovely. The first day we met a couple from Kerry on the marina just walking along, and they said, look, we don't really follow rugby, but thanks very much for everything you did. And that kind of put things in context a little bit, and people have been super. It's one of those things that you always want to win, and you always want to be at your best, and we weren't, and it's disappointing, and New Zealand were very, very good. But it was one of those World Cups that everything was kind of a roller coaster, because New Zealand were massively up for our game because we'd beaten them two of the last three times, and they played super, and we played poorly in a number of ways. And so they then took that into the England game, and England were massively up for them, and they got knocked over. And then, England, were probably quite warm favourites, and they got knocked over, because I do think there's a real human factor and emotional factor in getting up and being incredibly motivated for a game, and then to repeat that the following week is sometimes a challenge, especially because there's 23 people who have to do it in a pretty connected way.
It's interesting, though, because I can even hear it in your voice still that obviously the World Cup, it did have a huge impact on you. How do you deal with that disappointment? And then you have to deal also with the disappointment of all the players and the backroom team.
Yeah. The good thing, again, for the players and the backroom team is, it was great last weekend. Everyone won, and this weekend it's all about the European Cup now. So those players, they're back on the horse and they're riding very, very well. So that's great. But that was probably the hardest thing for me, as I said earlier, that it is all finished, and it is a disappointing way to finish. And the World Cup, it is fatiguing. You're trying to work out who you might play next, and you're trying to do a very good analysis on them so that you can best prepare the team. And so you're trying to cover your bets. And we started with a 6-day and then a 5-day turnaround, and the humidity was high, and there's a lot of travel backwards and forwards to training venues just because of how condensed the country is, or the parts of the country that we were in were, because Tokyo is a very big city. So from that perspective, it is a bit hard to bounce back from. So, hopefully I get a bit of time and distance, and over that time and distance, it does fade a little bit.
Go right back, Joe. Bring me back to, is it Kawakawa? You grew up in New Zealand?
Kawakawa was where I was born, and then we shifted to a town called Te Aroha. Te Aroha means the love in English, because it's Māori. And then we shifted to Woodville. And so those are the three very small towns where I spent my childhood and teens. And so towns of 1,400 or 1,600 people, it's not a lot of people. So, I'm a small town boy, and that kind of gave rise to the title, because I don't think I'm any different from that small town kid. You grow up and you're the same person 30 years on, and it started with an email that arrived at the RFU asking, was I the same guy who was playing backyard footy with Ellison's two younger brothers, and I was and I still am that same Joe. So I think the other part of it is just that I think everyone is a little bit ordinary, but if you work away at things and you try to develop a really good work ethic and a good set of skills and have good values, then sometimes extraordinary things can happen. And I've had an incredible privilege of being on the fringe of some really special days.
But given your incredible success, you could have easily called this book No Ordinary Joe.
because for me, I want people to believe that doing things is accessible. You know, you don't have to be someone who's not ordinary. And I think if, you know, I try to maintain a growth mindset, and I try to maintain a positivity, and even in defeat, I try to take the learnings from it. But I try to take learnings from winning as well. And so I guess, you know, that's an ordinary thing to do. And if you can do the ordinary things really well, then I still think you may get the opportunity to have some extraordinary results.
So what formed you? You're one of eight children. Tell me about your siblings and your mum and dad, and I suppose the ethos they built into you.
Yeah, I think it's revealed a little bit, because one of the reasons that I chose to write it myself was to keep a personal voice, but also it was, my mum wasn't well at the time, and that was a tough period just before the World Cup. But so we kind of started writing it together, and I've always been, impressed by how intelligent my mum was. She read constantly, and her geographical and historical knowledge, you know, we just didn't bother playing Trivial Pursuits with her. She would sometimes play the whole household by herself. So, that was part of it. And because she had a love of reading, I think it's easy to pick that up. Even though my preference was being out and about, throwing a ball around or swinging a bat at things, there was always time for reading. And I think, you know, my siblings, we had a couple of really good days together recently, it's just great to spend time with them. It's a lot of kids in a family, and so part of it is that it was a very disciplined environment, and you had to follow the rules. And if you were told to be home by five, you know, if you were a minute after five, you're in trouble. And you were taught to take responsibility for yourself. So getting a paper run young and working in a nursery and having to take responsibility for yourself, I think was something that was really positive in my upbringing.
They were very strict, though, because I was reading the passage in your book where you got hit in school for doing something wrong, and then your mum was annoyed with you. Your dad saved you, actually, at the end of the day. Yeah. But are you as strict with your children as
No, it's a different generation, yeah. Miriam, I think. Yeah. And I'll never forget, because my mum laughed about it, and it was, you know, she said, look, it was all part of an act to make sure that you took responsibility for your actions. And if you were told not to speak in the classroom, and I got sort of halfway through explaining, you know, like my friend didn't understand the question. I was just trying to help him. And but you do learn from those things. And it doesn't mean that you won't take that risk again, but you'll also not try to avoid the consequences if you do get strapped for it as you did in those days. They don't do that anymore.
No, thank God.
A bit draconian, but we did laugh about it. I still probably, some of those disciplinarian kind of, I suppose that platform did give me a good springboard, because I did definitely take responsibility for myself.
You mentioned there that your mom hadn't been well before the World Cup. Will you tell our listeners, there's a beautiful story about your son Tim coming in with a card from your mother. Do you mind telling that?
Well, it's a little bit tough to tell, because one of the things about the World Cup is when my mum did pass away, it was in the week of the Italian game. So I kind of got back to to watch the Italian game. And I think that it's something that you know what, I tried not to process it. I just wanted to get on with things at the time, because I felt that I could process it later. And it's one of those things that that I'm looking forward to catching up with my siblings again and spending a little bit more time to probably work my way through that. But I knew when I got the card that I wasn't going to cope overly well reading it, because she'd been very close and she'd been part of this project and I didn't expect that it was going to happen. I was moved by the words she said, because she knew me so well, and she knew that what she said would mean something to me.
Tell people what she said. Basically, she wrote the card knowing she wouldn't be alive to see the World
Cup.
Yeah,
and I'm sure a lot of people do that, and they want to have a special word at a special time, and it was that she wanted me to get the card on the morning of the quarterfinal. So luckily, we didn't get beaten out in pool play, Miriam. She just said, "Look, she's really something along the lines of she's really proud of my achievements, but she's proud of who I am." So,
Yeah, I have it here. She says, "I'm so proud of what you've achieved, but even more proud of what you have become."
Yeah.
Yeah.
So. Yeah. I try.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
And she's demanding. Even, you'd think that she'd finished demanding things of me by the time she'd shaken off her mortal coil. But that was a little bit of a tough moment. That became a tough day, and those, I think that emotional roller coaster, it's something that that just makes the day a little bit tougher to negotiate, really.
But how do you do that? I often wonder, because you are the coach, so you almost have to stay strong all the time. And yet there you are, you've just got this card from your mother just before the quarterfinal. I mean, do you just not want to go into the room with all the players and burst into tears and say, "Look, I've got really sad things in my life too"? But you have to stay really strong for them and hide your emotions, really.
I think you just try to put them on hold. And look, I show emotion to the players. I do. They know I'm disappointed, and I came back into the changing room after doing the media, and I think both Rory and I felt incredibly disappointed, and the players, every one of them, came up and they were great, I do really feel privileged to have worked with such a good group of people, and that's the staff, but the playing staff as well, and the RFU have been incredibly supportive. From that perspective, it is a little bit easier to keep your emotions in check as far as the external happenings are concerned, because internally we're all emotionally connected to the game and how hard the players try. It's not like a job where you can just leave it and it doesn't make a big impression on you, and you're conscious also. The biggest thing for me is how conscious I was of, you had to be in that stadium to hear the Fields of Athenry during the Aka. It was, it's emotional, it's huge. And you feel that all those people have traveled over and are disappointed, and so it kind of magnifies your own disappointment. So that whole day, it's probably not going to be a favourite day for me. And I love the words that my mum used, because, it reveals that she knows me inside out, and also she knows what would mean something to me. It's a little bit special as well as emotional.
I was thinking coming in this morning as well, how do you tell players difficult decisions? Does that ever get easier? Like, I was reading the stuff about, Devon Toner not bringing him, and maybe that was over a suspension. But in general, how do you tell players' disappointing decisions. Does that ever get easier for you? Do you just feel really bad?
Yeah, because I people don't see how hard they work behind the scenes and how much it means to them. People see a performance for 40 minutes and then another 40 minutes, but they don't see how hard and how meaningful representing their country can be for these players. And so I know that I'm effectively taking something away from them that they've worked so hard to achieve. And I'm really conscious of that. And we, as a coaching group, we spend a long time making those decisions, but then we also spend a fair bit of time talking through the key players who have missed out and trying to best summarise a way back for them or the reasons for doing it. And sometimes the reasons are, there's a very fine margin and they're hard to actually verbalise. Sometimes it's a gut feel because, you know, you might have a set of stats or you might have the visual footage or whatever, and you're trying to align two different players, and sometimes it's the best fit. You know, you kind of feel you need one of these sort of players as opposed to one of those sort of players, so a player might miss out. But, you know, you mentioned Devin Toner. Dev had played more test matches for Ireland than any other player up until recently, because when I started, he started really becoming a cornerstone of what we were doing.
You very briefly touch in the book on the rape trial in Belfast. That must have been a very difficult time.
Yeah, it was difficult only because it's something that became incredibly invasive in the environment, because we usually live in this bubble, but something as big as that and as public as that, it did put real pressure on. It wasn't until the Friday that we started to find out the vitriol, and that really impacted on the hashtag Not My Captain, impacted on Rory, and we were incredibly conscious that it's a very tough period for the people involved. You know, obviously the whole court case is, you know, I can't imagine what it's like for those who are on either side of it. It was one of those things that normally things outside the environment we can keep out of the environment, but it was very, very tough.
And it's interesting because I sit to be in front of you now and you're by nature a gentle person, but I suppose there is that toxic masculinity people speak about, that maybe some part of rugby needs to catch itself on and shouldn't be like that. I'm not saying anybody particularly is like that, but rugby has an image sometimes of being very male, very masculine, and maybe not respecting women enough.
Yeah, the fastest growing part of rugby is female rugby, Miriam. So I think, you know, the amount of supporters who are female, I think physical contact is something that if you're describing as masculine, you're probably saying to those women, why are you playing rugby? Mm-hmm. So I think it's the fastest growing part of rugby around the world and in Ireland. So I think it's a part of the game, and it's something that the women are just as active in trying to challenge themselves physically as the men are. And I do think traditionally, because women didn't play the game, it was a very male-dominated domain. But more and more so, you know, in Hong Kong this year, the two sevens teams will be playing side by side. You know, the Six Nations are mirrored with the men's team and the women's team. So I think from that perspective, there is always change. And that is fairly constant. And I'd like to think that change will continue. I'm not saying that, you know, that all men and all women who are playing the game are going to be necessarily respectful to each other. But I would love that to be the case, because one of the things that I tried to instill in the players is a real value system. And I do believe that they are a great bunch, the vast majority of the time. And, you know, I think society has a cross-section in any domain, and And I think those things are changing.
You pay great credit in your book, Ordinary Joe, to Kelly, your wife, and your four children. And I've met you at charity events for epilepsy because you're very involved because of your beautiful son, Luke. Remind people about Luke.
Luke is at Tyrannia College now, and he's in his transition year, and so he is literally transitioning into that life after school where he's been in such a secure environment, and they've looked after him so well. We discovered he had a brain tumor when he was 4 or 5, and has had a series of neurosurgeries since that time, and has suffered from seizures ever since that time. And you know, one thing people wouldn't know is I arrived home from the World Cup feeling sorry for myself, and I walk in the door and he's having a seizure on the floor and Kelly's alongside him, and you know, you get a sense of the reality of what his life is, and I'm feeling sorry for myself, you know. And I think that's something that you know, is you can grow from, you can understand. I don't think I'm visible trying to help epilepsy, but I do try to help other charities. And I know one of the things that I describe in the book is taking the players for Christmas dinner, but they don't really get fed. They're there to feed others and help pack food parcels at the Capuchin Day Centre. That building of values, that understanding of a community responsibility and the impact they have. You know, last Christmas, the feedback we got from the Alone people and the people that we visited, just for a cup of tea, just simple things that you can do to contribute to the community. But if you've got a profile like some of these players, that magnifies the impact they can have and in a really positive sense. And so probably the frustration for me around the trial was how hard kind of we were working to try to keep growing the values in the group, and you know, I'd hope that people would see on a broader scale that those values are demonstrated by the team.
Will you miss Ireland?
I'm not going anywhere. You know, we'll be here till the end of the school year, it's been incredible for the family, how well they've been looked after and the experience we've had here. And so Luke will finish the school year, and not like I'm a soccer coach, Miriam. I can't really retire permanently. I'm not sure if I'll ever coach again. It's not kind of on the radar, but I will have to go to work at some stage. So the next 8 months I will kind of tread a bit of water and try to help kind of work out what we do and where we go next, particularly in line with Luke, and then I'm not sure what that will be, and you know what, even better, I'm trying not to think about what that will be. I'm trying just to slow down a little bit.
As we come to the close, what would be, or is this a very tough question, in terms of your career with Ireland coaching, what was the highest moment? And I assume the World Cup was the lowest moment.
The World Cup. I mean, you know, some of the highest moments are seeing the guys get off the bus and go into the Capuchin Day Centre, and the way that they...
Brother Kevin,
champion.
Isn't he a saint?
He is such a nice man. And, I think they were more of a distraction than actually functional, because the volunteers got distracted and everything else. But just seeing the way that they react to that and then on the pitch, I think just a few of those really special moments. You know, away in South Africa when we were down to 13 men for 10 minutes, 14 minutes, for 14 men for 60 minutes, and still managing to get that away win. And, you know, obviously Chicago was special. The win against England in the Grand Slam was really special, because just the whole circumstances of that, and it was -5 degrees. It was so cold, and how warm we felt, and then the day after when we couldn't get the flight out, and just being able to spend that time with the players in a relaxed way and probably treasure those moments a little bit.
Mm. Look, Joe Schmidt, I loved your book. I'm not a rugby expert, but I found it really great read. Ordinary Joe by Joe Schmidt is published by Penguin Ireland. And Joe, you're going to be in conversation in Dublin, Limerick and Belfast. And tickets for these events are available from penguin.co.uk/events. Joe, on behalf of everyone in Ireland, thank you so much for everything you did for our Irish team.
Thanks, Miriam.
A huge reaction there to Joe Schmidt. I'll just bring you some of it. Moore says, Joe Schmidt is a beacon of light, hope and courage and an inspirational, awesome human being, showing such sensitivity and so humble a person. So proud to have had him as manager of our rugby team. And in terms of value system and humanity, he is Olympic gold. Well done, Joe. You're a true hero and an incredible human being. Desmond Hay says, top man, Joe, we as a sporting public owe you great thanks for all the highs, and they were fantastic, and even the small lows, which make us humble and grateful for our lot. Onwards and upwards in your and your family's great journey ahead. Paul McQuillan says, brilliant interview with Joe Schmidt, definitely no ordinary Joe. Mary Conroy says, huge gratitude to Joe, disappointed with the result in Japan, but never with Joe or the players, wishing him and his family a great future wherever they go. And I'll bring you one more. Hi Miriam, I'd like to pass on the title of this poem to Joe Schmidt. It's about bereavement and it has helped me. It's called On the Death of the Beloved by the Irish poet and philosopher John O'Donoghue. It can be found online by doing a Google search. Kind regards. I'd be here all day reading out the rest of those comments, so I won't. But my next guest this morning shot to fame here in Ireland when she said on the BBC Question Time television programme that Ireland owes the United Kingdom nothing over Brexit. She was inundated with praise from Irish people and social media, a reaction she found both moving and unexpected. Her name is Bonnie Greer, a writer, actor, critic who's lived in the United Kingdom for more than 3 decades, but is originally from the south side of Chicago. And she's just on her way to Ireland to take part in a European Movement Ireland event, which is taking place tomorrow evening in the National Concert Hall. Good morning, Bonnie Greer. Thanks for joining
us. Morning. Look forward to seeing you tomorrow.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for joining us, Bonnie. Listen to me. We're going to just remind people. We're going to play that clip of you on okay. Question Time when you became famous okay. in our country.
Oftentimes right. I hear people talking about Ireland as if this country owns Ireland. Ireland owes this country nothing. Ireland owes this country no concessions. It owes it no quarter. It owes it nothing. And the third thing I want to say is that the United States is Irish. And if anybody thinks that they're going to get a deal through and have a relationship, a trade relationship with the United States Absolutely. That shafts Ireland, you got another thing coming.
Bonnie, were you amazed at the reaction? Because I gather you do tweet, but you're not massively into social media. So were you amazed at the reaction?
Absolutely. I when you do that show, and I don't have Twitter on my phone or anything because I'm too compulsive, so I've avoided that. And so, you know, you do the show and the people in the audience react to you the way they do, and then you go back to your hotel and then you go home. So I had no idea until I got into Liverpool Street Station and people were staring at me. They were taking my picture. I thought, oh, I've said something horrible, but I don't know what I said. this Irishman walked up, this guy, walked up to me, and he said, thank you, and can I take a picture with you? I thought, what happened? And then I found out.
Incredible. Listen, go back a bit, Bonnie. I mean, I think you're one of 7 children born into a very segregated country. When did you become aware? Tell me about your background, first of all, Bonnie, about your parents, and when you became aware of racism and prejudice.
Well, I was born on the south side of Chicago. I'm the oldest of 7. And we lived in, you know, basically a ghetto. It wasn't a bad neighborhood, but it was a segregated area. And this and I grew up in the 50s and the 60s, late 50s and 60s. And, you know, my father was in the United Kingdom as a young soldier for D-Day. And he was very much a guy who was interested in politics. He worked on an assembly line, so he wasn't engaged in them, but he was aware, and he kept us really, really focused on that. And one of the ways that you could escape the segregated schools in our area was to go to Catholic school. So he scraped his money together and sent all of us to Catholic grammar and Catholic high school, and we were all baptized, and of course, all of the nuns and the priests were Irish, so are Irish descent. So that's how I became aware of the country and the culture.
And I think your dad, he descended, is that right, Bonnie, from Mississippi sharecroppers?
Yes, indeed. And because he grew up during the Depression in rural Mississippi, he couldn't even vote. And he saw some pretty horrific things. And he never forgot them, and he never let us forget that that's where we came from, too.
I assume also, Bonnie, growing up on the south side of Chicago, you must have followed the trajectory of the Obamas very closely. I mean, what did their rise and influence mean to you?
Well, it was really funny because, Miriam, because I was living here when President Obama came on the scene. And, you know, I'm a 70s generation, and what we did as black kids is that we changed our names to African names. And so when I heard the name Barack Obama from Illinois, the first thing I asked in London, well, what's his real name? And this young guy said, I don't know what you mean. I said, that's not his name if he's from Illinois. And but it was his name. It is his name. And so that really put me into that generation. And also, I just wished my dad had been alive when I saw him, the president, for the first time step off Air Force One. That's when I knew it was real. And I just burst into tears. It was incredible.
Why and how did you end up going to live in the United Kingdom?
Well, I was coming, I was on my way to Paris, as a lot of African Americans of my generation were, and I was invited to do my play in at the Edinburgh Festival. And so I'd written it, and I had a troupe, and so we did. And then I got a job in London in a theater company, a women's theater company. So I thought, okay, I'll stay here a couple of months. And it expanded into a couple of years and decades.
And you're still there?
Yes, I am.
One of your plays, which I think is wonderful, tells the story of how Marilyn Monroe helped Ella Fitzgerald's career. I didn't know much about this, which was being stymied, of course, by racial prejudice.
Yes,
and the
yes.
color bar, because she couldn't sing in certain clubs. Remind us of that. I didn't know that.
Well, in about 2003, I was working on another play, and I happened to turn the television on, and I saw this documentary called Marilyn in New York. And I used to belong to the Actors Theater's writing group in the 80s when I lived in New York. And I knew some people who knew Marilyn Monroe, and they told me she was very different from the person she was on the screen. So I was curious about this program. And part of it was the fact that she had helped Ella Fitzgerald get a booking at one of the most prestigious clubs in the United States, Macambo. And Macambo had had African-American performers there before, so that wasn't really so much of an issue. I think as I've researched this and written a few plays about it, I think Ella didn't fit the Macambo type. I think it's more that. And Marilyn had become a huge fan of Ella Fitzgerald, and jazz musicians really respected Marilyn because she had exquisite timing. And one of the things that helped her have this timing is that she listened to Ella Fitzgerald records because Marilyn had a stammer. And so Ella's diction, which is amazing, really helped Marilyn to get over her stammer. And she just became attached to her. And when she found out that Ella may have wanted to be in Macambo, and it may have been on the grapevine or something, she approached the manager who she knew, and she said, please let her book her, and, I'll be there.
Were you really interesting? You also wrote about your mum in A Parallel Life. Remind us of that lovely scene when I think your dad is dying.
The one that I remember, the only thing that I really remember now at the moment about my mother was her sense of humor. And even when our father was dying, she's a big smoker. And our father was dying of cancer. And she said to him, he said to her, you shouldn't be smoking around me. And she took the cigarette out of her mouth and she said, what do you think, I'm going to kill you or something? And he just burst out laughing. And, that's the kind of woman she was.
Now, since the Brexit debate has been going on in the UK, you've lived in the UK for 30 years. Is it a very different place at the moment? Is the atmosphere quite different?
Yes, I live in the West End, so there are communities that I don't know on the ground about. But I have acquaintances who are Polish and who also are Muslim and Muslim-identified, and it's become rough, especially as you're speaking a foreign language on the street. And people will basically tell you to speak English, and I've seen it. So it's Brexit has dug up something in the British character that I had never seen before. And I don't think it's more, you know, unusual than any other country, but I've not seen this part of the British character before. And it's very dismaying. I mean, it's very xenophobic. There's a lot of anger. There's a lot of rage, and people sort of heading for the cliff edge, and they don't seem to care. And I don't know where that kind of attitude comes from, but it's really polarized the country and made it very difficult for foreigners to live here. It's hard. And I said that on Question Time. It's hard.
Well, look, Bonnie Greer, as I said, you're going to be speaking at the European Movement Ireland event tomorrow evening in the Kevin Barry Room at the National Concert Hall, 5:30 p.m. And for more information, tickets, the website is nch.ie. Bonnie, it was a joy to speak to you, and we'll chat soon again.
And you too.
Take care.
I really look
Bye,
forward
Bonnie.
To it. Thank
Bye,
you.
Bye, Bonnie.
Bye-bye.
Take care. And I've been rejoined in studio by Cork's own Jack O'Rourke. Jack, you sang for us earlier, and you're going to sing for us again. You're also a teacher by day, because I have interviewed you before. Tell
you
me
have.
About that.
Yeah. About the interview or my job? My other job. I'm working in a grade school on the north side of Cork City, Gael Coláiste de Mhuire on Bannister Huig. It's a Gael school. Inner city school, great kids, yeah, great place.
What do you teach?
Music and English, yeah. Bearlog is cool, and it kind of takes me out of my own head, you know, the artist's head.
Do they think that you're very cool because you're a singer-songwriter?
Sometimes, but, you know, but I'm their teacher too, you know, so.
Yeah, are you strict?
I can be sometimes when I have to be, but I don't need to be a lot. But it's great working with young kids, and they keep me up to date too on everything that's happening in pop culture and hip hop and all that, you know.
Everything else. And as I said at the beginning of today's programme, Hot Press said of your new album, Jack, that it has established you now as one of our greatest, most gifted songwriters. And of course, your song Silence, it became something of an anthem, didn't it, for the marriage referendum?
It did, yeah. Kind of unexpectedly, because it's slow and it, you know, it's not exactly got a gay club beat, and it had a lot of chords, but somehow it became it resonated with people, because I think it was my story of a young boy, and I think rather than shoving down the Yes campaign down people's throats who didn't really understand what it was all about, I think when they reflected on the fact that it was about a young boy who somehow realised he was a bit different, very very young, I think it made them maybe empathise a bit more and maybe change their opinion.
You're from Ovens, of course, but do you think the referendum, do you think Ireland is completely different? I mean, you're gay, you're openly gay, you're here with your lovely boyfriend this morning. Did it change everything in a way?
I think it has in a lot of ways, because I think young people growing up now, I think having that, you know, is very, very a big deal. It's something that's multi-layered and something deeply ingrained in people's consciousness, that if it is allowed, you don't have to think about it as much. But I do think, and even listen to Bonnie Greer there talking about Britain, I think 80% of people are there, you know, in terms of, you know, being open-minded. But I think in general, people, society in Ireland and in Europe and in Britain have to catch up with our laws in some ways.
And in terms of your own career, I mean, is there a moment when you might put your teaching career on hold? I mean, obviously, I remember even David Kitt writing and speaking some time back, like, it is difficult to make it.
It's hard.
As a singer-songwriter, and you know, and with the cost of living. So obviously that would be a big decision if you ever did make that decision.
It would. I have a good balance at the moment, and I love teaching. And, you know, if I look back at the last, you know, 5 years since I started releasing my own songs, you know, there's many moments that I go, wow, I can't believe that happened. But I have a good audience. I'm not trying to compete with Justin Bieber, you know, yet, you know, but, you know, I like that balance, you know, and it keeps me grounded.
And a number of our listeners, Muireann Nicaudy goes, there's Jack O'Rourke being deadly on the radio this morning. Brian O'Connell says there's the incredible Jack O'Rourke. Suzanne Doyle also raving about you. How do you write a song? Do you have a discipline about, do you sit down and say, I'm going to write a song today? Or does it just come to you at different times?
It depends. I'm not that disciplined as a person. I have to work at it. Nick Cave, apparently, I didn't realise this. He goes, you like to think your heroes that Alleluia came to Leonard Cohen out of the sky, but apparently it took him 7 years. So it's like anything else. You have to go in, Nick Cave, you know, excuse my French, you said if you throw enough muck at the wall, something will stick, you know. So that you have a lot of rubbish and you look back at stuff you wrote last week and you go, oh my God, that's so embarrassing. But you might have one line. That song I played this morning, I was actually listening to something by Anna Mika, a new folk singer, and the song kind of wrote itself. Silence wrote itself, and that's the reward. But more often than not, you're toiling away and changing things and editing all the time, you know.
Also, as a singer-songwriter, and even in your own songs in particular, do you ever feel exposed and vulnerable? Because songs, they're very personal things, aren't they?
They are.
Yeah.
I think, with something like Silence, but I suppose the first album was very personal and introspective, but I think this new collection of songs on Ivory Towers and Showwomanship is playlisted on RT at the moment, so that's been incredible for, you know, bringing people to gigs and stuff. RT Radio 1 are fantastic in supporting new Irish music, and I'm proud to say that. But I think that's a bit more universal, you know, and I think it just happened that the songs are a bit poppier too in terms of production. So it depends, you know.
So tell us about your new single and album, and then I'm going to give, actually you're playing in the Inkwell Theatre in Tracton and Cork on December the 14th, you're in Cocklands and Cork on December the 18th, the White House in Ballincollig on January the 4th, and the Bowie Festival on the 9th of January at the Workman's Club in Dublin.
Yeah, so good, nice few gigs coming up. I'm writing at the moment, and I suppose the last album, it was like a mini album, Ivory Towers, lots of upbeat kind of pop rock songs. I was listening to a lot of Arcade Fire and the War on Drugs, but I'm going to do a tune now written by John Prine, which I think is kind of important for this time of year. Just listen to even Joe Schmidt talking about bringing the players to visit old people. I think they often kind of get neglected at this time of year, and I'm reading a book at the moment, and in Oriental culture, old, you know, people who are elderly, and that chain, that's different for each person, but they're really revered, and their wisdom. And I think often here, you know, and it depends where I'm teaching in Cork, the nan or the grandmother is the matriarch, and you know, she's what she says is gospel. But I think maybe some of our cultures and generations have forgotten that people who are older have a lot to teach us as well.
That's a really good point.
Yeah, so check in with them this Christmas.
Yeah, good point. Wait one second. So you're going to sing Alone by John Prine. Just to say, the winner of our competition today is Shoon Hurley from Skibbereen and County Cork. This is a very Cork show because she's picked the tickets to go there. On sound today was Harry Bookless. Our BCO was Denise Davies. Our producer, Shan O'Gorman. Thank you all very much for listening. We'll go out now with Jack O'Rourke singing Alone.
Thanks for having me, Miriam. This is a John Prine tune.
Had an apartment in the city, me and Loretta liked living there. It's been years since the kids have grown, lives of their own, left us alone. John and Linda live in Omaha, Joey's somewhere on the road. We lost Davy in the Korean War, still don't know what for, it don't matter anymore. Good old trees just grow stronger, old rivers just grow lonesome, waiting for someone to say hello in there, hello. Me and Loretta, we don't talk much now. She sits and stares through the back door screen, and all the news just repeats itself like some forgotten dream that we've both seen. Someday I'll go and call old Rudy. We work together at the factory. But what'll I do if he asks what's new? Nothing white's with you, nothing much to do. Good old trees just grow stronger, old rivers grow wider every day. Old people just grow lonesome, waiting for someone to say hello in there. If you're walking down the street sometime and spot some hollow ancient eyes, please don't pass them by and stare as if you didn't care. Say hello in there.